If you brought a Bible with you this morning, I'd like you to turn to Philippians chapter 2. Really, let's begin at chapter 1 and we'll get over to chapter 2 before I'm through here. I have some things I want to share this morning and tonight and tomorrow morning that will be pointed, direct, and perhaps a bit convicting. That reminds me of the story that Steve Farrar tells in his book, Finishing Strong. Willie and Ray are two ranch hands that are meeting at the feed store one afternoon. "Had some problems with my herd," said Willie. "My prize bull was impotent. But the vet came over and gave me some special medicine, and now he's doing just fine." Several weeks later, Willie and Ray met again at the feed store. "Hey, Willie," said Ray, "now my bull is having the same problems. What's that medicine the vet prescribed?" Willie said, "I don't remember the name, but it kind of tastes like chocolate." I mean, sometimes a little strong medicine is good for us. And I think I've got that in mind when I talk about this subject this morning that seems always to be appropriate when you get together with a bunch of Christians. It's one of those things that we all know is that important, but we tend to overlook it because, well, it's a checks and balance thing for us. And it's hard to maintain a balance when we don't check ourselves at this point. It has to do with what I would call, aside from our relationship with Christ and our relationship within our family, our wives and children, it is to me the most important priority as it relates to getting along with others, and that has to do with our attitudes. I told you to be strong medicine, so we might as well face it at the front end. Johnny and I were together for a meeting some time ago, and he slipped something in my hand. He had read it that morning in the USA Today. I thought the statistics were such that it really deserved to be repeated every time I talk on this vital subject. A survey of the major Fortune 500 companies around America had been taken, and of all the 15 qualities the CEOs in these companies said they were looking for among their employees, 72% listed first a great attitude. They listed it before intelligence, skill, education, knowledge, expertise, business savvy, appearance, and experience. A great attitude. I wasn't at all surprised. I find that it is invaluable for me in getting along with other people and frankly in cultivating a relationship with God that's meaningful and real that I regularly address my attitude. It's a very tough thing to define. What Hendricks would call it's in that slimy ooze of indefiniteness that the definition falls. It's hard to get a handle on it. We know when it's right. We obviously know when it's wrong in ourselves and others. But we can't quite define what it is. Sometimes it's our reaction to a testy situation. Sometimes it has to do with our patience or lack thereof in a time of waiting. Occasionally, it has to do with working with people who are hard to be around. Often, it has to do with how we're feeling at the time. And we tend to rationalize our way through a bad attitude by just sloughing it off and saying, "I just don't feel that well today," when in fact, we feel fine. We just don't want to deal with our attitude. I was thrilled when I began to think about some of the examples of attitudes that have stood out in my mind. Niccolo Paganini is a great violinist and was standing before his beloved Italian audience in one of their concert halls a number of years ago and playing this magnificent concerto. has the instrument under his chin. The orchestra is playing beside him. The conductor is perspiring, and they're moving through this magnificent piece, and all of a sudden, a string breaks on his instrument, hangs gloriously down. He frowns. The conductor frowns. He improvises on the other three strings and goes right on. As they turn the corner and come toward the finale, a second string breaks. Now he knows he's in trouble. In fact, the whole orchestra knows he is, because they can see now these two strings that are sort of swinging in the breeze as he's playing and improvising on two strings. And just as he gets to the crescendo of the last part of it, a third string breaks. He's got one string left. And amazingly, the man finishes the piece on one string. And of course, before he even comes to the end, the Italian audience, they're on their feet, they're screaming, they're yelling, they're throwing flowers, they're all excited. Some of them start to leave. They know there's not going to be any encore. He says, no, sit down, please. Hush comes over the audience. He holds up the instrument, and three strings hanging down. He says, and now Paganini on one string. And he plays the encore on one string. Of course, the newspapers the next day are full of Paganini on one string. Paganini on one string. And I might add, an attitude of fortitude. My mind goes back to a 16-year-old teenager who dives off a barge in Chesapeake Bay back in 1967, as I recall, and Johnny would never be the same. Never had any feelings from her shoulders down from that time on. And if you know Johnny Erickson Tata, as Cynthia and I do, you know this is one woman who has found an answer to life that has to do with her attitude. What a remarkable person she is. Just her smile from that wheelchair ignites a place with encouragement. I've said on many occasions it's Johnny Erickson in one string. An attitude of positive determination not to give in, even though she is a victim of paralysis and will be until she dies, save a remarkable miracle from God. I've had the joy of hunting and fishing in Alaska with a remarkable athlete, at least he was before cancer took his arm, Dave Dravecki. Some of you who follow baseball remember that Dave is one who was in the rotation of the San Francisco Giants when they were winning the pennant and then on to the World Series. And he was so determined to play, even though they found that malignant tumor in his shoulder, that he played against all odds. In fact, after a surgery, he went back to the mound and pitched again. And slinging that ball to the plate, he literally threw his arm off. It hung only by the tendons. And you know the story that followed from the neck all the way down to the armpit. They've removed his arm. His only source of making a living as far as his familiar world was concerned. And I have seen Dave Dravecki with one arm catch more silver salmon in the Kenai River than the others of us could do with both arms. And yelling and laughing. And I've stood on the end of the boat and watched him, and you just forget that he has only one arm. He also had a rod and reel I'd like to steal from him. I mean, who couldn't catch with a one-arm rod and reel? It was terrific. He and I were laughing about that later. But never a word, never a glimmer, never a comment of self-pity or blame. It's Dave Dravecki in one string. A magnificent attitude of determination. Viktor Frankl, if you've read his works, you know, was taken before the Nazi Gestapo. They took his practice, they took his family, they took his jewelry, they took his clothing, they shaved his head, his family all killed in the Holocaust. And this Jewish physician standing before the white lights of the interrogating committee as they glared at him, and he suddenly realized, it came into his mind a realization, they can take my family, they can take my practice, they can take my clothing, they can take my possessions, but they can't take my choice of attitude. That's mine to choose. Viktor Frankl and one string. The stories go on and on. You have your own, perhaps someone in your family or someone you admire some leader that shaped your life, even some comedian that's made you laugh. The stories are amazing when you search into the lives of great individuals. They are often stories of enormous tragedy, heartbreaking accounts of loss of family members or loss of some great dream or the death of some hope. And it's their attitude, that one string that they play on, that shapes everything about them. Paul is a remarkable man. Some admire him for his theology, and who wouldn't? He forges out a New Testament theology under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, shaping our thoughts in the Constitution for the Christian, the book of Romans, and this magnificent message of liberty in the book of Galatians. I mean, who wouldn't be admiring Paul for his magnificent mind? But if you ask me what I admired most, it's his attitude. His attitude. He came toward the end of his life. Not at the end, but toward the end of his life. And in thanks for all of his sacrifice and labor and work and missionary journeys and remarkable achievements, he winds up chained to a Roman soldier under house arrest for 2 years, during which time he writes four of the wonderful letters that keep us on the edge of our seat. One of them is the letter to the Philippians. They're called prison epistles. Prison epistles. He wasn't really in prison. They were letters written while he was under arrest. And this is one of them. It's easy to forget when you read this letter on joy that it was written while he was literally tied to a Roman soldier day after day. People could come visit him, but he couldn't go out for a walk. He couldn't leave and pick up something at the snack shop. I mean, he couldn't go on a little weekend trip. He was there for 2 years. And you have to look, and you'll look in vain to find one word of blame or self-pity. I mean, it's Paul in one string. Look, for example, at some of these wonderful words he writes. He says in verse 3, after a simple salutation, he says, "I thank my God." Now, if I were writing the letter, I'd probably start it with, "I question my God." Or, "I wrestle with my God." Or, "I've got some concerns about the justice of God." Or, "At times I blame God." He doesn't do any of that. He says, "I thank my God in all my remembrance of you." See, they couldn't take his memory away. They could tie him up to a Roman soldier, but they couldn't make him think what they wanted him to think. That's his choice. Just like it's yours. Nobody makes you respond as you do. You respond because you want to. You have a habit of doing it. Or you want not to. He says, "I thank my God for in all my remembrance of you, always offering prayer with joy in every prayer for you all." He was from the south. "In view of your participation in the gospel from the first day until now." He said, "I'm thinking back to when we first got together, and when I think about our relationship and our months together, I'm filled with joy. I smile on the inside when I think about the Philippian people." Well, what about your situation, Paul? Verse 12. "Now, I want you to know something, brethren, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel." Is that great? I mean, aren't you tied to this soldier? Yeah. I mean, aren't you limited in your ability to get out and around? Yeah. I mean, you can't travel, right? No, I can't travel. Then how you figure that it's turned out to the greater progress of the gospel, he says in verse 13, "so that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everyone else." Well, I hope to shout. I mean, he had a guy tied to him. Talk about a captive audience. Every day, he could talk to Stephanos and say, "Well, while you're sitting here, I need to tell you about Christ." "Well, I don't want to hear about it." "Well, I need to tell you anyway, now that you're tied to me." And so he starts talking, and he leads one after another to Christ. And when they get off duty and go back to the Praetorian barracks, guess what they talk about? This man that they were tied to through the day. So that by the time a period has passed, the whole Praetorian Guard under Caesar had heard of Christ. That's what you call a great attitude. He didn't sit there and complain about his situation. He talked about the power of Christ and the ability of changing a life. So the whole Praetorian Guard. In fact, look at the last chapter, one of my favorite sections of the book. He says in verse 21, greet every saint in Christ Jesus. The brethren who are with me greet you. All the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household. How did they find out? Well, word leaked from the Praetorian Guard. Got through to the maids, who got through to those underlings, who got through to the other people they were serving, and finally got across the whole household of Caesar. Why? Because of a great attitude, frankly. I know the power of the Holy Spirit was at work. I know that God was using truth in the lives of individuals, but the source, the fountainhead of information, was Paul, and he refuses to be negative about his situation. I love to be around people like that. One of my all-time favorite stories is about the farmer who lived next door to the farmer that was negative. And the farmer that was positive was determined he was going to make that negative farmer see the good side of life. I mean, if it rained, this farmer next door would say, it's just going to absolutely flood the crops. We'll never be able to even make our bills because we're going to have everything washed out. And when the sun would come out and stay out, he'd complain about how hot and the drought that was sure to come. Well, this other farmer decided, I've got to find a way that'll make him think of things positive. So he buys this remarkable dog, brilliant dog, and he teaches him to walk on water. When they hunt the ducks, this dog will walk across the water, get the duck, and never get wet. Come back and drop it in the boat. He's going to take his neighbor. He never tells him, he trains him. So duck season comes, he gets his neighbor in the boat, and they go out in the blind. Boom, boom, boom. They shoot three or four ducks out of the sky. The dog jumps out, runs across the water, gets the ducks, brings them back. He looks at his neighbor, he says, how about that? Neighbor says, he can't swim, can he? You know, it's remarkable to me, some folks are going to find the one thing that isn't there. And you may be one of those people. And you know, we're involved in training critical minds, crucial thinking people, folks who are discerning, folks who see through error and deceit, folks who deal with the text and analyze it. I got a friend in Texas that calls it super irrigating it. They kind of super irrigate the passage. They just work on words and prepositions and nouns and verbs. And they're critical as they see the text. And if they're not careful, they'd be critical about how they see life. And people are not really people to love. They're people to analyze. Congregations aren't people to love and serve and shepherd. They're people to control and take advantage of in times, even be in charge of wrong attitude. We're involved at Dallas Seminary in training servant leaders who will serve the work of Christ worldwide. And if we graduate people who see the need to control others, we're missing it. We're missing it. The apostle never pulled rank except when truth and error were at stake. When he was dealing with individuals, even hard-to-handle individuals, it is remarkable how great his attitude was. Now, I'm going to just throw this out. No extra charge for this little tidbit. But the deeper you get in the Scriptures, if you're not careful, the more you'll let your attitude drift. You get a little crotchety. You get a little demanding. Even get a little severe. How wonderful it is to find people who are deep in God, but gracious and tolerant with other individuals. When you get over to chapter 2, you see some of that mentioned in verse 3 and the verses that follow. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. Boy, those are strong words. Look at the word nothing. Talk about a temptation to supererogate. Nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. But with humility of mind, that's an attitude, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. I don't want to go too fast here. This is rich soil. Let each of you, moms and dads, parents with kids, husbands with wives, mates with parents-in-law and with parents. You with your pastor and pastor with the flock. Let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. That's a mouthful, isn't it? I understand toward the end of his life, when he had become so mellow and gracious in his brokenness over the whole Civil War battle, Robert E. Lee was standing in front of a woman who had a new baby. And she asked General Lee if he would bless her child. And he took the little boy in his arms and he cradled him with great tenderness. And he looked into the eyes of the little boy and he looked into the mother's eyes. And he said to the mother, "Teach him that he must deny himself." You teaching that to your children? To your grandchildren? Because they're not going to learn it in the corporate world. They're not going to learn it on the streets. They're not going to learn it in the scouts. They're not going to learn it in their little youth choir. They're going to learn it from you. Teach him that he must deny himself. Every once in a while, I like to read Eugene Peterson's The Message, a paraphrase of the New Testament. Listen to how he handles this. Don't push your way to the front. Don't sweet talk your way to the top. Put yourself aside and help others get ahead. Don't be obsessed with getting your own advantage. Forget yourselves long enough to lend a helping hand. Isn't that beautiful? Hey, you say, well, listen, I've dealt with people longer than you can imagine, and they can get really pushy. They can get really difficult to handle. And for you, I have this little piece. People are unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Love them anyway. If you do good, people will accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Do good anyway. If you're successful, you win false friends and true enemies. Succeed anyway. The good you do will be forgotten tomorrow. Do good anyway. Honesty and frankness makes you vulnerable. Be honest and frank anyway. What you spent years building may be destroyed overnight. Build anyway. People really need help. But they may attack you if you help them. Help people anyway. Give the world the best you have and you'll get kicked in the teeth. Give the world the best you have anyway. Guess what that's called? Anyway. Yeah, right. No, it doesn't matter. You see, attitude is more important than how people respond. And it doesn't depend on that. Attitude is more important than the stuff that you can't change. Though we spend so much of our time addressing the things we can't change. The time. The weather. Older you get, the more you watch the Weather Channel. You can't change the weather. Sometime it'll show more rain, and I'll say, more rain? You know you're getting old when you talk to the television. More rain! I can't change it. My grousing about it won't change it. God's plan is going to work. It's carrying on. And my attitude is to say, thank you, Lord, for whatever you send. You've got a reason. You've got a reason. There's been more rain, more flooding this year than ever, ever in what? They're saying now 500 years of our history. Tragic stuff happening. But you know people who are making it? The ones with great attitudes. When the storm swept through Miami and blew those houses away, my brother had just moved in south of Miami. Just moved in after 32 years, missionary statesman in Argentina. And that's his welcome home. Comes back, buys a little house, and whew, half of it blows away. He and his family are hiding away in the master bedroom closet as they're hearing the roof torn off and doors ripped off their hinges. And boy, he said, part of my roof wound up blown through my garage. And he calls me the next day. He said, Charles. I said, yeah, you okay? He said, yeah, I'm fine. He said, you know, the great thing about this storm, blew all the fences down, we get to meet our neighbors. That's not irresponsible. That's a great attitude. You know, the only thing they had for electricity was a little generator that they got and they put outside because there was no electricity for many, many days down there. And so they plugged into this generator, and that was the only way they were able to run the air conditioner that was to cool their house. And while they were napping one afternoon, he noticed the air conditioning went off. His neighbors told him next day that they watched the people steal their generator. I still didn't hear my brother grouse about that. You grouse about no air conditioning? I usually do. You grouse about it when somebody rips you off? Cynthia will never tell you. I tell this story about her because I'm so full of admiration for her. When I was in the Marine Corps, she was living with her mom and dad. We weren't able to bring our wives overseas, and so we were over in Okinawa for those almost 18 months. And while she was there, she worked as the secretary of the president of a bank. And she met a lady who didn't have a place to stay, and very graciously, as Cynthia would do, she says, "Why don't you come home with me tonight? We've got a place. We got a room. My mom and dad wouldn't mind at all. They'd love to have you." So they fed her a nice supper. And through the night, the gal stole her mother's jewelry and left. I've never heard Cynthia complain about that, or her mother, who died very young with cancer. You know why? Great attitude. You know that I have met people that are so bitter, hung up on something that happened 14, 18, 22 years ago, and they're still carrying that thing with them, venting their spleen every chance they get, unloading some unforgiven spirit. You know the secret of it? Just forgive them. Just love them anyway. I mean, the easiest thing for her to do is to say, "That's my last time trusting anybody. I mean, they ripped off my mother. I'm not going to ever reach out again." By the way, sometimes it's wonderful to reach out. You get rewards that you don't expect. My daughter-in-law heard the story from a woman who really knew the Trumps well. Donald Trump, when I give you that name, you probably first think of some greedy prima donna who lives in, you know, the high rises and looks out for number one, and maybe there's that true about him, but let me tell you another side of him. Limousine was on the side of the true story. Limousine was on the side of the road with a flat. The guy in a pickup notices it's got a flat. So he pulls over behind this limousine thinking, well, maybe they need help. People are probably all dressed up for a banquet. So he goes up, raps on the window, and the guy slides the window down. It's the driver. He's got a cell phone in his hand and trying to get help. And it's on a day when everybody's off and nobody wants to help. He says, "Hey, let me fix the flat. I'll be glad to fix this for you." The guy says, "That'd be fantastic. I'll be glad to pay." He says, "I don't want any. I just want to fix your flat. Give me the keys." So he got the keys. Fixed the flat, put it back in, wiping his hands off, gave the guy the key back, and he says, "Look, can I do something?" He said, "No, I just want to help you out. Now you're on your way." All of a sudden, the back window slides down. Donald Trump sticks his head out, and he says, "Thanks. What can I do for you?" And the guy says, he notices who he is. He said, "You know, Mr. Trump, there's nothing you can do. Really, I don't want a thing." He said, "No, there's got to be something." He says, "What can I do?" He says, "You know what? I'm married. My wife would love to have a bouquet of flowers from Donald Trump. She would never believe it." He said, "Give me your name. Give me your address. Let me write it down." So he gets it all. The guy doesn't have a card, so he writes it all. Trump writes it all down. 4 or 5 days later, the doorbell rings. Love this story. And the wife goes to the door. She opens the door, and here's this guy with a big bouquet of orchids. Oh, it blows her away. It's bigger than their dining room. So she brings it in and she sits it down at the table and she looks at the card. "Whoa!" She said, "This is from Donald Trump. Look!" And he says, "Yeah, I know." And on it is a note that says, "Your husband helped me out the other day and this is my way of saying thanks." And she turned the card over and it said, "And I've also paid off your mortgage." The moral of that story is help people with flats and limousines. Don't ever drive by a limousine with a flat. You'll stop and help people and they'll rip you off. In fact, I've heard of them stealing from people that stop and help. It doesn't mean you never stop again. It's an attitude matter. Don't look out for your own personal interests, but for the interests of others. Ministry is people. And it's not limited to the clergy. I've learned my best lessons of serving from the laity. I've learned much about compassion from people I've gone to visit in a hospital who minister to me more than I ever could to them. Cynthia and I know a lady that throughout our entire 23 years in Fullerton Church suffered from MS, could not move a muscle from her chin down. She could look, she could nod, but that was about it. She was fed, dressed, all of her hygienical needs had to be taken care of the entire time we were in Fullerton, California. When I would go visit Jerry Nigrin, I would come back and say to Cynthia, I didn't minister to Jerry Nigrin. She ministered to me. Why? Great attitude. Smiled, her face lit up. Pastor Chuck, can't believe you'd take time to come. Sit down. I'd sit down by her, and before I'd be reading her the scripture, she'd be quoting me verses she had just been reading that morning or had been read to her or something she heard from our program on the radio. Overflowing with grace, not looking out for her own self, but the interests of others. Friends, it's an attitude. Attitude. I wrote a little piece that got put into print, and where this thing is wound up, you'd never believe. My daughter worked for Nordstrom as one of their salespeople, and she said, Daddy, do you know that in the front part of the Nordstrom personnel handbook, your piece on attitude appears? And I thought, I've never gotten a discount at Nordstrom for this. Attitude! It's an attitude problem, I know. I had a Pennsylvania State Patrol top guy wrote me. He says, I don't know if you're the same one, but he said, man, he said, I want you to know I got every one of our cadets memorizing your thing on attitude. A gal told me who's a little a young adult son is now in the Los Angeles Police Department. She said when he went to cadet school there, first night the cadet officer who was training them said, you got one assignment tonight, and that's to memorize this thing on attitude. I went into the Harley shop in Dallas to have my Harley worked on. I drove in, and Harley people, you know, man, they're my kind of folks. You know, I walked in the back, and the guy, the service manager back there, and he says, yeah, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I'd like that so-and-so done. So he's taking it down like this. He said, okay, what's your name? And I said, it's Swindoll. He said, Swindle? I said, no, it's Swindoll. Yeah, I know, Swindle. He said, wait a minute, Swindle. Swindle. And he looks back, and there's this greasy thing hanging on the wall like this. And he said, the Scout's honor, these are his words, I'll be damned. You write down on attitudes? Well, yeah, it hadn't helped you a lot, but I certainly have. I wrote that piece on that. Things hanging there like this. Why? Because everybody you meet knows they need to do an attitude check regularly. You do before this conference is over. You did on your way to this conference. And I wasn't even there. I just know conferees. It's like the devil turns all his darts loose on people coming to conferences. It's remarkable. We've had people getting along great, and by the time they got to the conference, they're planning a divorce. It's remarkable. And on your way home, something's going to happen. Or before you're home for... Oh, I remember telling people, hey, watch out, because we're having a great conference, but when you get home, you're going to have a test. And our minister of music, Howie Stevenson, comes home, and he's starting to get in the door of his house, and he hears running water. Not a good sound when you're at your door and the lights are off, you hear running water. And he goes inside, and the toilet has overflowed. And the water has run out. And the ceiling, that's upstairs. And the ceiling above the dining room, and the chandelier is laying on it. That's what they came home to. Now, that's not... I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm just saying in case. Words can never adequately convey the incredible impact our attitude has toward life. The longer I live, the more convinced I become that life is 10% what happens to us and 90% how we respond to it. I believe the single most significant decision I can make on a day-to-day basis is my choice of attitude. It is more important than my past, my education, my bankroll. My successes or failures, fame or pain, what other people think of me or say about me, my circumstances or my position. Attitude keeps me going or it cripples my progress. It alone fuels my fire or assaults my hope. When my attitudes are right, there is no barrier too high, no valley too deep, no dream too extreme, no challenge too great for me. That's what I'm talking about. And some of you think what you need is just more time in the Bible, and that's always a wonderful idea. But I suggest you may need this afternoon a long, deep, honest look at your attitude. Because you formed a habit that goes way back to when you were allowed to pout. There you go. Or get moody. I had a very moody mother. I love my mother, but I don't like her moodiness. And at times she would just say, I'm going in my room and I may never come out. Clunk! And we thought, great. So she thought we were going to be in great mourning out there. And we thought, boy, Lord, don't ever let her come back out like this. I mean, you still do your little pouting, your little mood trips, your little bargaining.